Perfect Stranglers contains graphic and explicit content suitable for mature listeners. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Perfect Stranglers. This is Kylie.
And I'm Bree.
And you guys, welcome back. I'm excited. As you know, we record like in chunks of episodes, and we have some goodies today, which we'll get into in a hot sec.
Can't wait.
But I have to talk about my hair real quick, because you're my fellow cosmetologist and we're going to chat about it, because I need to go over my plan, okay? So listen in, guys. If you have never heard two cosmetologists talk about hair color, you're about to hear it. Okay, so my hair naturally is a level, I would say 8-9 CG. So copper is the tone, but like a copper gold is the undertone, because, you know, I'm a redhead, so there's no brown in it. All pheomelanin. And so right now, you guys don't see it, but it is probably a level 10. She's a level 10 with a hint of like a blue in it, because I took out all of the, I had pink, I had purple for a little bit. That's what our logo looks like. It has the purple to the blonde. And I was like, it was fun. Don't get me wrong. It was fun having a lot of fun colors, but I struggled because my outfits didn't match with my hair. Mm-hmm. It's not like I wear anything but like black and burgundy and like olive anyway. But I was like, also, like, bright colored hair is fun, but it's a lot of upkeep, and like, I'm a single mommy, and it's a lot of work, right? So what I'm going to do is I was going to fill, because you know how you always fill with like Shades EQ 9AA Papaya? Like, that's always the fill, yeah, that you do. For you guys that don't know what a fill is that you replace the missing pigment from taking out the color when you lighten. So I was going to fill with a 9AA, but I was like, you know what? I want to be like an 8 to 7 CG with a little bit of R, copper gold with a little bit of red, like Deborah Messing, only a little bit lighter. So I'm going to fill with a level 8 CR, and then I'm going to go over it with a level 7 copper gold. So I'm going to have that red undertone, but copper gold is going to go over at like a level 7. And since my hair is so porous, I got an 8 and a 7 to mix, but I think the 7 is going to overtake.
Yeah. What were the colors of the 7?
I have a 7 copper and then an 8 copper gold is going to be my final color. And then I'm filling with a copper red.
The 8 is a copper red.
The fill is, yeah.
That's interesting.
But my hair has that blue in it. Hair has that blue in it, so it's going to hopefully neutralize some of that.
Yeah. I probably never would have thought about that. Because, you know, like how you said you wanted like a little bit of each, the copper, the gold, and the red. I would have thought to mix that into the final formula. But you're like layering it. That's innovative. Yeah.
See, this is how I used to do my hair color in the salon to get like that undertone. So everyone always filled with 9AA just to replace that yellow and orange pigment. But I'm like, no, you need to throw in a little bit of that reflective undertone in it that you want for your final result to give you that dimension. Because as it fades, you're still going to have that undertone that you originally wanted as your final color as it fades in the undertone.
Yeah, makes sense.
That's my plan.
So new hair. What else is new?
I'm going to see Asking Alexandria and A Day to Remember tomorrow.
Okay.
Which I don't know if y'all know who that is. They're just like a metal band, rock metal, both of them are. I love Asking Alexandria. My friend loves, A Day to Remember. So yeah, I'm excited to go to a concert.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. Tell us about you. What did you do? Cause you just had a fun little fun time situation.
Yeah.
What'd you do?
I did. Well, first of all, I got new glasses.
You did, and they look really great, and I like them.
They glow in the dark.
Wait, they glow in the dark? Shut up.
Yeah. I don't know if you can see that.
I love that so much. I can. I can see it glowing in the dark.
Yes, I am 33 years old, and I ordered myself glow-in-the-dark frames.
I love it.
So what?
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, and I went to a music festival recently, and So I have a story from the music festival. So my husband was taking a nap.
Yeah.
And I decided to go off on my own and see this EDM DJ that was his show was starting. Okay. So I'm walking by myself and this guy comes up to me and he goes, "Oh my God, are you okay?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. And he's like, "Oh, are you sure? You look like you're suffering from vibrio." And I'm like, "What's that?" And he's like, "That's when you just can't stop shitting out good vibes to everyone." And, I mean, what do you say to that? So I just had a brief chuckle with him and we kept him moving.
Keep her moving. Oh my yeah. God, Vibaria. If we still named these episodes funny things, this would be Vibaria without a shadow of a doubt. Oh my God, I yeah. love it. Well, that's fun. So, did you have a good time?
Lots of characters.
A lot of characters. I've never been to an EDM festival, but I imagine a lot of glow sticks.
They don't do glow sticks so much anymore. It's a lot of LEDs.
Okay.
The glow sticks, you see, are bad for the environment.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have wised up to that.
Good. Apparently. Good on them. Good on them.
I, however, brought some glow sticks because I love a good glow stick. And, I mean, sorry, but I just love a glow stick.
Do you want to know? Speaking of, do you want to know my favorite saying is recently? Especially since I've been going to the chiropractor, crack my back like a glow stick, which has yes. many applications, many meanings. You can use it in a lot of different scenarios, bedroom. Like, it's just a great. It's just a great overall saying, you know?
Yeah.
I just love it. Well, that's good. I'm glad you had fun. You needed to get out and have a good time.
Yeah.
Now Nicole needs to go to a concert because we both are going to musical situations. Now she needs to go to a concert. Nicole?
For sure.
Your podcast moms say to go to a concert, go have fun, go do things. No, you know what? She goes to Ada every Saturday and has her little fun time. I don't know what she does, but I know that she goes to Ada and she like, I don't know, farmers markets. Something.
Okay. Yeah. I like farmers markets.
Yeah. I think that's what, Nicole, I don't know what you do on Saturdays. I just know that you told us that you go to Ada and it's been your favorite thing. Now I feel like I'm just having a conversation with her. Farmers markets. That's her thing. So we have a long episode. It's a Kylie episode that's true crime. So, you know, it's going to be a little bit lengthy. So we should get this going here. Bree, do you want to do some housekeeping?
Sure. I can do that. Don't forget to like and rate our podcast on Apple Podcasts. It helps us get seen and it helps people find us. Also, don't forget to subscribe to us on whatever platform you listen to us on so you'll never miss an episode. We also want to hear from you on our social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we also want to hear your true weird stories of things that have happened to you. So please email us those at contact@perfectstranglers.com. And while you're at it, check out our website, which is www.perfectstranglers.com.
Back to you in the studio. Okay, guys. So this is one that a few of my friends have been asking me to do. And it's one that we've talked about doing and that I just haven't done it because it's a lot. It's probably going to be our most modern serial killer that we do, I think. We are going to be talking about Israel Keyes. And I'm just so stoked because I just feel like, you ever like, we come across this quite a bit, I feel like, where there is a killer that you're like, why don't more people know about him?
Yeah.
Like, seriously. So this is going to be seriously one of those. Why don't more people know about him? And I'm going to start out with a quote because I like to do that. But it, I feel like it's a funny quote for what we're doing. Not like murder's funny, but you know, we got to make fun of something here. So first off, this is the quote from Israel Keyes in his confession interrogation chit chat with the FBI. He says, yeah, this is going to be a shock to a lot of people. My concern, the problem is nowadays, is the more stuff my name is attached to, the more likely it is that somebody's going to do some kind of stupid freaking TV special, or you know how it is nowadays, like with all this true crime bullshit people are obsessed with.
Is that right?
And I just was like, uh-huh. It's because we warn women out there about people like you, fuckhead. That's why. Okay.
Wow.
So let's get into it on Israel Keyes. Let's talk about his childhood. So he's been referred to as the most notorious serial killer in a generation and the most meticulous serial killer of modern times. His criminal activities spanned from 1996 to 2012. He was born in 1978 in Richmond, Utah. He was the second child of John Jeffrey Keyes, who was a maintenance man, and Heidi Hackinson. They had 10 children total. Which is just a lot.
That's a lot of kids. Dare I say, too many. That's too many kids.
Yeah, that's like one of those people who are pregnant all the time and you don't know what your body's like, not pregnant or post-pregnancy. You know?
Yeah.
Like, because you're just like, you're always pregnant. So soon after his birth, the Keyes family moved to an area in Stevens County. So I'm going to throw my phone over there. In Stevens County, Washington. Sorry, I just lost my place because I was moving my magic. I have one of those magic, we're going to talk about this for a second. I have one of those magic mice, and if you even like sneeze at it the wrong way, it moves all over your screen. Because it's the whole mouse is ran by the touch of your hand. So even if you touch it slightly,
yeah,
it pisses me off. Anyway, sorry. So soon after his birth, the Keyes family moved to an area in Stevens County, Washington, called Aladdin Road, where John Keyes purchased land. His parents were fundamentalist Mormons, which is also how he was raised, and he and all of his siblings were also homeschooled. When we talked about Jodi Arias, did we talk about soaking?
No. I don't know. I don't think so.
Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not gonna say it, but it's been a thing on TikTok where non-Mormons are finding out what soaking is. If you Google it, do incognito and don't use it on your work computer. Not safe for work. But also Google soaking because it's fucking weird. Anyway. So while living in Stevens County, Washington, they attended a Christian identity church called The Ark, known for its racism and anti-Semitism, with a like little sprinkling of survivalist lifestyle, which Israel later said was an Amish way of living. Heidi and John Jeffrey Keyes had very strong personal beliefs and a general mistrust of the government and a mistrust of modern medicine as well. They lived off the grid, no electricity. They had a wood fire for heat, like wood fire stove oven thing for heat, in a cabin in the middle of the woods, middle of nowhere. All of the children were born in the home without any medical assistance or clean running water. May I repeat that?
Oof.
And they were socially isolated on purpose. The only social interaction they seemed to have was when interacting with members of the Ark. So the ARC, which is still a functioning thing, is now called Our Place Fellowship. It's led by Pastor Dan Henry. And also in Aladdin Road, the family became neighbors and friends with future white supremacist and family annihilator Chevy Kehoe and his brother Shane, which we will be discussing in a few weeks. So it's... Okay. Everything is intertwined. The next couple episodes that I do, everything is intertwined. It's like a part one, part two, but loosely related, but it's related.
Uh-huh.
It got me into this like mind fuck of what the hell? Honestly, yeah. I just had to. My search history, RIP, because it's bad. Government, if you're listening, I am sorry. I'm sorry. So the Keyes and the Kehoe families also attended services by another nearby Christian identity church called the Christian Israel Covenant Church, led by Henry's neighbor and friend, Pastor Ray Barker. So I didn't know what a Christian identity is. Like, I didn't know what a Christian identity church was. It's an anti-Semitic theology that sees Jews as an evil force and claims the Bible is actually the history of white people. The most malicious Christian identity followers believe that Jews are biological descendants of Satan.
Oh my
and
God.
And are working to prepare the earth for the return of their daddy, their founding father, the devil.
That is...
wild, right?
That is not the word for it, but yeah.
Yeah, I can't comprehend. I don't have the mental capacity to comprehend why someone would think that way. You know what I mean? Like, you just can't get it.
Yeah, I'm astounded. Wow.
So that's what a Christian identity church is.
What the fuck?
This is why I went down this rabbit hole, because I was like, this is so bad. I want to know why people believe in this, because their minds have to be so fucked up. I need to know more.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So hence my rabbit hole.
Wow.
So during the childhood years, Keyes would walk around with a pistol everywhere he went. At the age of 14, his grandfather gave him a .38 caliber revolver, which he outfitted with his own homemade silencer. He and his friend also had a habit of breaking into houses and burglarizing them. During his police interrogation, Keyes actually admitted he developed a really strong interest in guns and hunting at a very early age because of that. And to encourage his growing obsession with everything gun and death, he often stole guns from his neighbors. In addition to hunting animals, he also began torturing them, which is one of, like, the big three.
Yeah.
Wetting the bed, animal torture. Well, fire, I guess, is in there, too. So big four. Fire is, like, a 0.5. And a frontal lobe injury. So he did that. Keyes said while he was in custody, I've known since I was 14 that there were things that I thought were normal and I thought that were okay, but nobody else seemed to think that they were normal and okay.
Yeah.
Like, he knew that something was off. So between 95 and 97, between the ages of 17 and 19, he started working in a 7-man crew for a construction company, doing custom work for customers with needs beyond construction. Later in the 90s, his family moved to Maine, where they became involved in the maple syrup business. It's there that he rejected his parents' faith completely and openly declared himself as an atheist. And as a result, he was kicked out of his parents' house.
Okay.
By the age of 20, Israel Keyes joined the United States Army, which, why the fuck would you let him join the Army? I'm sorry. Anyway, he joined the United States Army, and with the exception of being cited for driving under the influence, he didn't receive any reprimands and was honorably discharged in July of 2001 after serving 4 years. After that, he lived on the Maka Reservation with his daughter and his girlfriend. So he ended up having a girlfriend and having a kid. So the FBI has the most comprehensive timeline I have ever seen for someone. They don't only have his murders, they have where he was just lollygagging, fucking around, just like living life. A whole list. It's unreal. It is so cool, you guys. It's so cool. But he's so modern that we know everything about him, you know?
Wow.
So, like I said, I'm going to do this in timeline order according to the FBI's timeline. Keyes committed his first major crime sometime between 96 and 98. The reports on that one was very wavering on the actual dates, because when he did his interrogation, he would barter for information with the authorities, with the FBI. So I kind of were taking like these beginning things like with a grain of salt until we had solid evidence. He targeted random people all across the United States to avoid detection, with months of planning before he did something. He specifically went for campgrounds or isolated locations, like in the woods. He also used guns when he had to, but preferred strangulation because he liked to feel and see people suffer at his own hands. He got off on it. He also had a rule that he would never kill children or any adult who had a child or was with child, because he had a daughter. Which is weird, because he's a serial killer with a moral compass.
Oh, okay.
An alleged moral compass.
That is weird.
Isn't that odd?
That is odd.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes, you know, you hear a lot about, like, they, you know, they were a very caring, you know, parent or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyone outside of their family, I mean, they right. didn't care about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, he was very strange.
Yeah.
Very strange. All right. So between 96 and 98, Keyes claimed he abducted a teen girl in the late afternoon, early evening on the Deschutes River in Washington. This girl was tubing with her friends when the abduction occurred. He sexually assaulted her and then let her go back tubing down the river. The victim was believed to be between 14 and 18 years old, and investigators believe that she never reported the case to law enforcement, which is very common.
Yeah.
And Keyes was living in Maupin, Oregon, and the abduction likely took place near Maupin. We're going to say Maupin. Okay. Keyes admitted to investigators once he was caught that in the late night, Keyes admitted to investigators that once he was caught that in the late 90s, very early 2000s, he killed four people in Washington State, saying his first murder was committed in 98 before pausing for 3 years while he was in the Army. So it's also very rare for them to be able to pause what they're doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was an odd duck when it comes to murder. Huh. He was a weird one. So the claims are, those claims of him pausing are now subject of an active investigation by the FBI as well as the police in that state. Specifically, what is under investigation is Keyes said he killed an unidentified couple in Washington. He did not tell law enforcement the couple's relationship to each other. It is unknown if the victims were residents of Washington State, if they were tourists, or residents he abducted from a nearby state and taken to Washington. He hinted that these victims were buried in a location near a valley. Keyes possibly moved their car after he abducted them to place distance between where the vehicle was and where the crime occurred. As a specialist in the U.S. Army, he was stationed in Fort Lewis, just south of Tacoma, Washington, between 98 and 2001. He also lived in the small city of Colville in eastern Washington and in the Maka Reservation community of Nia Bay, in Washington. Authorities are currently reviewing unsolved murders and missing persons cases in that area to determine which cases, if any, may link Keyes, even though he said he was in a 3-year killing hiatus. So he said he wasn't killing, but somewhere between 98 and 2001, slightly before and slightly after he was out of the Army, he apparently killed an unidentified couple.
Okay.
Yeah. But they're like, did you though? So let's investigate and see if between that time frame, when you say you weren't doing anything, if you actually are telling the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So between 2001 and 2009, he's now out of the military. He confessed to at least one murder in New York State. Authorities have not determined the identity, age, or gender of the victim or when or where the murder may have occurred, but regard the confession as credible. Keyes had ties to New York State. He actually owned 10 acres and ran a cabin in the town of Constable, New York. Keyes also confessed to bank robberies in New York and Texas, as he had lived in Texas for a short time while enlisted in the Army. So this dude was all over the place. Like, we've created a triangle from Washington State to Texas to, like, Maine and New York all the way over. Like, everywhere. Covered a lot of ground. After making travels also to California, Washington, all of New England, Keyes decided to rob a bank in order to fund his crimes. On April 10th, 2009, allegedly after abducting and murdering a man, he walked into the community bank in Tupper Lake, New York, donning sunglasses, a jacket, jeans, gray sneakers, two-toned gloves, and a fake mustache and goatee, armed with a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol. He successfully robbed the bank. He fled and buried a toolbox about half a mile down a path in the Woodside area in Essex, Vermont. The toolbox contained a desiccant, a Smith & Wesson gun, and a Ruger charger. 4 days later, he returned home by airplane, I believe to Alaska, as he had resided there at this point with his on-again, off-again girlfriend and their daughter. So this is the first that we hear about his murder kits.
Okay. Wow. So he just, like, went on a murder vacation and then, like, went back to his family?
We'll get into it. But yeah, basically.
Wow.
Well, yeah, he's unlike anyone that we have seen and likely will see again, I feel. He also started his own construction company, Keys Construction, in Alaska, which actually did fairly well, and the reviews say it was reliable and trustworthy. So this is another guy that we have who, at home, was living a fairly normal life. He had a successful job. He would help out around the community. He had a daughter. He had a girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
Like, seemingly normal.
Like John Wayne Gacy.
Yep, exactly. So, he spent the next 2 years of 2009 and 2011 repeatedly traveling through the country for a variety of undisclosed reasons. At the time between April and May of 2011, he constructed a homemade silencer for the Ruger Charger pistol and decided to test it out during his next crime. So, after flying to Indiana and then driving over to New York State to attach and test his silencer, Keyes then drove up to Vermont, where he recovered the toolbox he had buried 2 years earlier that we had just mentioned.
Oh, wow.
He decided to randomly target and murder someone before going on a bank robbing and arson spree, in which he did confirm with authorities that he not only did that, but he burglarized a Texas. He went down to Texas and set a Texas home on fire. He was doing these burglaries and robbing houses to fund his criminal activity.
Oh. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
How enterprising.
Yep. So after selecting a location to take a victim, an abandoned farmhouse in Essex, Vermont was where this one is. I think Vermont or New York. The same, they're like right next to each other. Okay.
Yeah.
Upper New York, lower Vermont, you know. Keyes readied his weapons and began inspecting motorists from the safety of the nearby wooded area. Initially, he wanted to target a motorist driving a yellow Volkswagen Beetle, but Keyes found the plan impractical and switched his focus to a couple instead. So wandering around the suburban neighborhoods in the late hours of July 8th, 2011, he set his sights on 8 Colbert Street, occupied by Bill and Lorraine Currier. The home was less than half a mile away from Handy Suites Hotel, where he was staying. Keyes reportedly broke into the Currier's home on the night of June 8th and tied them up before driving to an abandoned farmhouse with them. He then proceeded to shoot Bill Currier before sexually assaulting and strangling Lorraine Currier. However, their bodies have not been found, and we'll get into why their bodies have not been found a little later. So I want to talk more about these kill kits real quick. So 2 years prior to the Currier's death, Keyes hid that murder kit or the kill kit that we talked about near their home. It had the handgun and various supplies. He also used these supplies during the murder of the Curriers and had these kits planted in various locations throughout the U.S. And he would plant them and then leave. So he would get the geographic location of these things. He would gather the supplies, plant these things, know the exact, like, longitude and latitudinal like areas, and then come back years later and use them to kill people so that he wouldn't be seen in a store that day collecting stuff to kill and get rid of the body.
That's incredible.
Isn't that like so
just all the planning?
I hate to say it was well thought out. The organizational skills. It is though, like the organizational skills to know where it is, to trust that no one's digging up a new housing development or anything. You know what I mean?
Right. And, you know, most women just want their man to, like, plan one date.
Right.
You know, but this guy...
he's playing murders years in advance, man.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. Isn't that insane?
If he just would have put that energy into something good...
Into his business, his construction business, it could have been a franchise.
Right.
Could have been a franchise. So he would, as he was doing his travels, because the question is, like, how does his wife not know that he's traveling, or his girlfriend or whatever? How does his colleagues not know, like, what he's doing?
Right.
So he would travel under the guise of visiting distant friends and family members, going on vacation, and no one suspected that he was going on these multi-state killing sprees. In these kits that varied, but it was the weapons that we said, also duct tape, shovels, guns, rope, Drano, and lye. and they were safe from the elements and from like animals getting in them and everything. And in the special on oxygen called Method of a Serial Killer, Special Agent Jolene Godin said Keyes would usually plan his kits before identifying potential victims. She said the planning really started when he buried that kit in that location. I haven't seen anything like it. And then forensic psychologist Dr. Thomas Powell told Oxygen, the ability to delay gratification, to have a kill kit and not act on it, was very atypical. You don't see that kind of patience in people who do this sort of thing. He probably waited with a great deal of excitement.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
This is, when I tell you this man is the most terrifying killer that we have probably talked about, it's that. That is it.
Wow.
That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry about my paper, guys. This is a podcast with a lot of notes. So the FBI determined that Keyes took as many as 35 trips between October 2004 and his capture in March 2012 throughout the country. And they believe he claimed multiple victims with and without using kill kits during this time. So, from 96 to 2011, Keyes started in Washington State, traveled between around the country from Washington to New York, New Jersey, California, Vermont, and everywhere in between. During this time period, he also had the daughter with on-again, off-again girlfriend. And then they moved up to Anchorage, Alaska, all murdering and killing and robbing banks and all of this shit all along the way. So we're going to get to his final person that he killed, Samantha Koenig. So Keyes' last known murder was the kidnapping and murder of 18-year-old Samantha Koenig, a barista working in Anchorage, Alaska. So prior to February 1st, 2012, Keyes had selected the Common Grounds coffee stand located on Tudor Road for the site of the abduction. Picture mocha.
Okay.
Okay, small, tiny mocha. Okay. You just walk up to the window, get your coffee. Keyes had never met or seen Samantha Koenig before. He approached the coffee stand just prior to closing time wearing a ski mask and ordered coffee. Samantha made the coffee, handed it to Keyes, and this is all on video footage. There's video of their interaction. Handed it to Keyes. He then pulled out a gun and demanded money. Samantha threw her arms up. She complied, and then Keyes forced himself inside the coffee stand and tied Samantha's hands with zip ties. So in that coffee stand, there was a panic button. She could have hit the panic button, but she didn't, which I'm assuming was just like that frozen fright that we've talked about. Yeah. Like, you know you're supposed to do it, but you don't, and you're like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
He asked her where her car was, and she told him that she did not have a vehicle. Keyes then forcibly walked her out of the coffee stand towards Tudor Road. Samantha broke away from Keyes, tried to run away. Keyes chased her and tackled her to the ground. He put one arm around her and pointed a gun at her body, and with the other hand told her that she needed to cooperate, that the gun had a very quiet ammo, the silencer that he made, and that she should not do anything to make him kill her. So pointing the blame towards her if she dies. Such a narcissistic fuckwad.
Yeah.
That's murder gaslighting. Throwing it out there. So they walked across Tudor Road into the parking lot between an IHOP and a Dairy Queen where Keyes' white truck was parked. Keyes had previously prepared the truck for the abduction by taking the mounted toolboxes off the bed as well as removing the license plates. So this man was prepared. Keyes then bound Samantha in the truck and drove away. They drove around town. He explained to Samantha that this was a kidnapping for a ransom. And Samantha told Keyes that her family did not have much money and that Keyes was not likely to get much in ransom. Keyes explained that they will raise the money for the ransom by seeking the public's help. So Keyes convinced Samantha that if she cooperated, she would be returned to her family unharmed. And Samantha believed him and tried to talk to him in an effort to convince him to release her, humanizing herself. At some point on the drive, Keyes realized that Samantha did not have her cell phone on her at that point, which was necessary for his plan to demand ransom money by sending a text message to her phone. So he's like, oh, fuck, what do I do? Because the place was about to close and whoever was going to pick her up was likely going to be there. But he risked it for the biscuit. He drove back to Common Grounds and re-entered the coffee stand, leaving Samantha bound in his truck. He got the cell phone, got back into the truck, and drove away. Keyes drove to a different part of town where he sent two text messages from Samantha's phone. The first message was to Samantha's boyfriend, and the second was to the owner of the Common Grounds coffee shop. The text messages made it appear that Samantha just, like, had a bad day, and she was leaving town for the weekend. Keyes then took the battery out of Samantha's phone. So Keyes asked Samantha for her debit card as well, and Samantha told him that she shared a bank account with her boyfriend and that his ATM card was in the truck that they shared. Samantha told Keyes where her house was and gave him the PIN number to the ATM card. Keyes put Samantha in the shed in front of his house, bound her, turned the radio up in the shed so that no one would hear her if she screamed, because we have, not only do we have some neighbors around, we have a girlfriend and a daughter. And I think the daughter was like 10 to 12 at this point. So they're curious, you know? But if your dad's fucking weird like that, maybe you're not curious. I don't know. So he told her that he had a police scanner and would know if she attempted to alert the neighbors. So Keyes, once again being risky, drove to Samantha's house and retrieved the ATM card from the truck. And while he was at Samantha's, he was confronted by her boyfriend, who yelled at him and then went back in the house to get help. Keyes snagged the car, ran back into the truck, and left the area before he could be found again. Drove to an ATM machine to test the PIN number provided by Samantha, but didn't take any money out so it couldn't be traced. And then returned back to the shed. Now, the original plan for the night was for Samantha's boyfriend to come and pick her up from work, but looking at the text messages throughout the night, after, like, the FBI took a look, because, you know, you always suspect the loved ones first, Samantha and her boyfriend had a pretty heated fight via text that night, so when her boyfriend came to pick her up and everything was shut down, the boyfriend assumed that Samantha's dad had come to pick her up. The boyfriend was really concerned and wanted to make sure that she did make it home on time, so he ended up contacting her dad and drove over to the house to make sure she was home. However, the dad said, "No, I didn't pick her up and I haven't seen her." Once both men, the dad and the boyfriend, realized that Samantha didn't make it home, they received that text message that Keyes sent from Samantha's phone, saying that she was spending the next week or so at a girlfriend's house. It wasn't normal for her to do this, but they figured, like, okay, we had a pretty big fight. Like, maybe she needs her space. They're just going to let it be. But they, like, knew something was wrong, and they were trying to, like, blow up Samantha's phone. But Keyes took the battery out, so they couldn't get a hold of her. So the two men stayed together that night, trying to call, get a hold of her. The next day, they filed the missing persons report. So while that's happening, back in Keyes' shed, he sexually assaulted Samantha, teasing her, telling her that she's not going to die, that she was a good girl, that she's being good. He actually told authorities while he was being questioned that she was good and she put up a really good fight and she was a really strong girl. I know.
That's weird.
Isn't that weird? Like, he was like it was an admiral fight that she put up, basically. Isn't that cringy, right? So Keyes sexually assaulted Samantha, and then he ended up asphyxiating her. He left her in the shed and then went back inside the house, where he packed for a pre-planned cruise that he was taking from New Orleans out into, like, the tropical area. I don't know where he went. Dominican, probably. I don't fucking know.
Okay.
He left early that morning, February 2nd, for the cruise with his daughter. All the while, her body's in the shed. So, Keyes returned to Anchorage on February 17th. It was a 10-day cruise. But it's February in Anchorage, so it's cold. The body isn't going to, like, you know.
Right. It's probably frozen solid.
Right? Yeah. So it was at that point that he began preparing a ransom note and demanded money to be placed in the account connected with the ATM card that he stole. He went into the shed, retrieved Samantha's body, taking, like, very big steps to make it appear that she's alive, posed her, had her dressed, and he sewed her eyes open.
Ew.
Her eyelids open. Mm-hmm. And the photo that he took showed Keyes' arm in the photo, but then the rest of her body, holding the Anchorage Daily News from February 13th, which is 4 days prior. So they thought she was still alive from 4 days prior when they got the ransom note. He photocopied the photo, he photocopied the photo and, using a manual typewriter that he purchased, typed a ransom note demanding $30,000 in the back of the picture. So after preparing the note in the photo, he placed it in Connor's Bog Park under a memorial flyer for a dog named Albert. Then, using Samantha's cell phone, put the battery back in, he texted her boyfriend telling him that the ransom note was, quote, under Albert, end quote, in Connor's Bog Park. The note was recovered by the Anchorage Police Department, APD. In the days that followed, Keyes dismembered Samantha's body and drove it out to Matanuska Lake, where he cut a hole in the ice and put her body in the lake. Meanwhile, Samantha's father, James Koenig, deposited reward money, which had been generously donated by members of the community, just like Keyes said would happen, into the account connected with Samantha's ATM card. The plan was to attempt to catch the perpetrator by tracking any withdrawals. ATM withdrawals were made in Anchorage and then in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. So they were tracking him as he was moving with his ATM card. And he generally used cash. When he was traveling everywhere, he was using only cash. That's why there was never a paper trail for him. This is like the first time there's actually a solid paper trail, was with this ATM card. So the FBI and Texas Rangers tracked the ATM withdrawals as they occurred, and ultimately Corporal Brian Henry of the Texas Highway Patrol pulled over a white Ford Focus that matched the description of what Keyes was driving. And he was in fact driving, and Henry, along with a Texas Ranger named Steve Rayburn, obtained enough information during that traffic stop to search the Ford Focus. Samantha's cell phone was found in the car, and the ATM card was found in Keyes' wallet. So he was then seized by the FBI for fraudulent debit card use. That's how they got him. And then he was a suspect in the Koenig murder. He was taken from Lufkin, Texas in March 2012 and extradited to Alaska, to Anchorage. Keyes was held at Anchorage Correctional Complex, and between March 30th and April 1st, 2012, he confessed to the murder of Samantha and confessed to multiple other crimes as well, and was indicted on April 18th. So his confessions and over 40 hours of FBI interviews are all on tape. Like, you can watch them. I watched a lot of them, and he is just a cocky son of a bitch. Every piece of information that he doles out is like, I'll give you this information, but you need to give me something back. And I'll give you this information, but I'm going to change my mind about it until you give me what I need. Like, something as small as asking for a coffee and a cigar.
Yeah.
Is like how he was bartering with things. Yeah. And he was like laughing and joking, and the way he was sitting in the chair was so relaxed, like leg out, arm up, just, yeah, joking around like a cocky motherfucker, because he was getting the attention he needed. And the FBI people that were interviewing him, they let him seem like he was having control of his situation, because he was that person who like the beginning quote that I read, where he was like, people are going to, some true crime show is going to make a documentary out of me. Well, that's exactly what he wanted. And part of me is like, then we're giving him what he wants. But also, like, you should be aware of how conniving these men are that do this shit. You know, like, I don't know. It's always like a double-edged sword. Like, I don't want to give these people a spotlight, but also, like, I listen to true crime to know what to look for. You know?
Right.
It's just hard. But yeah, his confessions and over 40 hours of FBI interviews are on tape. And he knew he had valuable information and tried to play mental games. Another thing about Keyes, as they were like talking, is that we found out that he was obsessed and very much so looked up and admired Ted Bundy. He studied Bundy extensively. And he admitted to heavily, heavily researching him among other serial killers. And he said he really enjoyed watching the news reports about Ted throughout the years. Bundy and Keyes shared a lot of similarities. They were both very heavy drinkers. The only criminal past Keyes had was that DUI and operating a vehicle without a license. They both traveled to kill, but for different reasons, and both got a thrill out of it. They didn't really kill for anything other than it was fun, and they both like got a rush out of the hunt, out of the chase and the act of killing itself. However, Bundy had a type, a brunette female with long hair, center part, you know, Keyes, on the other hand, he didn't have a type. He killed whoever was available, but his way of hunting and that was like the string tying it all together for him was the way of the hunt, not necessarily who you're hunting. It was also noted that Keyes spoke very matter of fact regarding his murders. He never showed any remorse when commenting on them, and he actually commented on other serial killers. He said Dennis Rader, aka BTK, was a wimp for showing remorse for his crimes. Yeah. In total, Keyes confessed to up to 11 victims, including two murders in Vermont, four in Washington State, one on the East Coast with the body disposed of in New York. In the past decade that he did these murders, investigators said there also could be three other victims for a total of 11, and likely countless other attempts at murder. He was also overseas in Egypt for a time in the military, so it's possible that this went international.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the only other known victims, as mentioned, are Bill and Lorraine Currier of Essex, Vermont. Keyes told authorities that after he sexually assaulted and strangled Lorraine and shot the husband at the abandoned house, the house was demolished and taken to a landfill. Keyes knew of the plan for the house, which is why no bodies have ever been recovered and no credible evidence was ever found. So when he broke into the house, like, there was glass, like, smashed. There is obvious evidence of a fight, but he did the murder, and then, like, it was literally, like, the next few days, the house with the bodies in it were demolished and crushed. So no one ever found him. Like, again, that's good planning. I hate to say it, but that's good planning. Asked if it's possible that Keyes exaggerated the number of victims, investigators say they believed what he told them. They never caught him in any lies they don't believe. Investigators said Keyes enjoyed the media attention his crimes received and did what many serial killers do. He would track the stories of his crimes from the news. He was actively tracking stories on the couriers on his computer. But when he learned that his name all of a sudden had been linked to the couriers by unconfirmed news reports, he quit speaking with investigators altogether for 2 months between July and September of 2012. According to Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew, he said he enjoyed seeing media coverage of his crimes as long as he wasn't connected to those crimes. He didn't want to see media coverage of himself.
Oh, wow.
Which is strange, again. So while being held in Anchorage Correctional Complex in Anchorage, Alaska, following his arrest, he awaited trial. He obviously was guilty. I don't know if Anchorage had the death penalty or if it would have been life sentences. However, it didn't really matter because he ultimately took his own life in his cell on December 1st, 2012, and was discovered dead on December 2nd. He inflicted fatal cuts on his wrists and had hanged himself using a rolled bedsheet.
Yeah.
With his death, Keyes wrote a, quote, ode to murder on in the form of a suicide note, which is a wild read if you ever want to look it up. It didn't provide any further information regarding the victims or details of his crimes, of where they are, but there was also a drawing of 11 skulls on paper drawn with his own blood found under his bed, giving further credibility to the presumption that there are 11 total victims from his killing spree that lasted approximately a decade to a little over a decade. And the FBI is still actively investigating the entire Israel Keyes case as a whole to uncover the identities and locations of the remaining 8 possible victims of Israel Keyes. And that's his story.
That's crazy. So there's probably like some cold cases out there that are connected.
The 11 possible victims that are dead, how many are alive that he either stalked or assaulted and got away with, like the girl between 96 and 98. And they uncovered some of his kill kits. How many kill kits are out there that he didn't know where they were or that may have been possibly dug up? You know?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's the psychological games. Like, he didn't... Strangulation is not the most graphic way we've heard of someone dying. By far, it's not. You know? But it's the mental games that's terrifying. And he just loved to fuck around mentally with people. Like, I could not... I just want to know... And I was going to look up the daughter and the wife, but I, or the girlfriend or whatever, but I just didn't feel like that was necessary. And I just don't want to pry into their lives because I'm sure they try and distance themselves as much as possible from being related to Israel Keyes or connected to him.
Yeah.
But like, he has 9 other siblings. Like, that gene pool and that ideology is so fucked, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just toxic.
Exactly. Yeah. So that is my story on Israel Keyes, and we are going to be elaborating on people connected to Israel Keyes here in a couple of episodes. So,
yeah. Wow.
If you like what you heard, feel free and drop us a line, as Bree says. Give us that 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and go ahead and send us a review and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, although we don't post on Twitter very often. And yeah, we will chat with you next Thursday.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Stranglers.